You're listening to the MLB.com StatCast Podcast.
Welcome back to the MLB.com StatCast Podcast. I'm your host, Mike Petriello. Big show this week. We're actually going to be talking about the Nationals pretty much the entire show with two great guests who are both at Nationals Park right now as we speak. The first one, pro bat flips, pro Carlos Gomez, pro dogs, anti-Billy Joel. One of my favorite radio hosts, Mike Farren, hosts the Power Alley on SiriusXM every weekday at 10 a.m. Eastern. Mike, how are you?
I'm good, Mike. It's great to be with you.
Absolutely. So listen, you spent your last weekend in Boston as the MC of Sabre Seminar, which is a kind of an annual gathering of all of the brightest minds in the baseball business. And I unfortunately was not able to go. So this is my first question to you. I want to know, you know, what was your takeaway from that? What was the best thing you saw, heard? Or maybe the appropriate question is, was it more fun after hours than the actual seminar?
Well, is this the part where I'm supposed to say it was all the brightest minds in baseball except for you, Mike?
Well,
really all of them?
I didn't think the check had cleared yet, but if we want to go with that, sure.
No, it's a great event. You're right. And so, I mean, this year, you know, there tends to be kind of themes every year, whether it's intentional or not. You know, Dan Brooks and Chuck Korb, who organize it, really do a terrific job. And whether it's intentional or not, they kind of end up with themes. Last year, I felt like it was more about this is going to sound weird, the performance enhancement in from a sense of, you know, how do you get the most out of your players? What do you do, you know, psychologically, physically, whatever, to get the most out of your players? How can you do that? How can you make their performance better? This year, a lot of the focus was really on science and technology. And not so much on StatCast, which was interesting, because I think people are still trying like heck to go through the volumes of data that I knew you have to go through on a daily basis, too. But things like hit tracks and the Zep analytics and your swing mechanic sensors that give you an idea on a hitter's bat speed and bat path. Some of the Modus sleeve, which works with pitchers to kind of show how much stress they're putting on specifically the UCL. So I think that was kind of a lot of the focus ended up being on the science of technology and that next kind of step forward. And then something that I think has become more and more part of the conversation over the last year, and that's how do you get analytics to the players? And some really great stuff from Dan Mack and John Williams in the Royals Analytics Department. And this may shock some people. The Royals actually have one of the larger analytics departments in baseball. And they talk a lot about, you know, how they have to get buy-ins from players or how they work to do that to communicate to show that this isn't about criticizing players. It's about trying to find ways to make them better. And, you know, we've seen that with the Pirates having guys on the road from the analytics staff. And certainly that's, you know, that question got asked. And that's not really the Royals' philosophy with it. But they talked about how they're able to provide that data and how they're able to get the most out of the players using it. And I think that was really eye-opening for a lot of people who were involved.
Yeah, I think you hit on a great point there, because every team has smart stats guys, right? But it's really the teams that get on the field. You mentioned the Pirates. We had Travis Sochik on a couple weeks ago, and obviously he wrote a great book about that. We had John Baker last week, former Major League catcher, who was also at Sabre Seminar. He talked about that a lot. And that really is kind of the next frontier. It's not just having smart guys. It's getting that data on the field. And I think that's really what the difference is. Like, this is where the wins are coming from, are the teams that can actually make that happen. And it sounds like that's a lot of what you heard this weekend.
Yeah, and I think that's it just makes sense. I mean, it's like, how good is an idea if you can't communicate it? And obviously, you know, when you're dealing with analysts and you know, stat analysts, you're dealing with incredibly smart people. But you have to understand that the language of the analyst is a lot different from the language of the player. Like, it's a little different than the language of the executive of the coach, too. And so, you know, what good is an idea if you can't communicate to the people who need to know it? Now, obviously, not all of the analytics are things that need to be known by players. You know, I don't think any player really needs to know what their you know, wins above replacement are, or, you know, anything that you're using to evaluate a player as a whole. But when you're talking about a lot of this granular data, especially as it comes down from, you know, how you might be able to get more RPMs on a breaking ball, or how you're able to get a better understanding of how to use your hot zones as a hitter. But that kind of stuff becomes really important in being able to communicate the idea and to be able to build trust. And a lot of that is based on communication, on being able to hear information from them, allowing them to ask questions of you as an analyst. Because if they're able to do that, then you're going to get buy-in, and they may have some questions, ask some questions that you haven't considered, or that maybe the analyst, you know, has some more insight on that helps make them a better player.
Well, it sounds like a ton of fun, and I really hope to make it there next year. You know, something else I wanted to ask you, obviously you've got your daily show with Jim Duquette on SiriusXM, but you're also pretty well known for the college game, right? Yeah, I think you were in San Diego a couple weeks ago for the Perfect Game Classic, and you've got your show on Sunday nights about the college game. We're always telling people, whether it's minor leagues, amateurs, you can't scout the stat line. Like, a batting average in this league may not be that important, but when it comes to stuff like spin rate and exit velocity and the stuff we're measuring with StatCast, that might even be more important in those kind of leagues than in the pros, right? And that's the kind of stuff you really want to see out of a young player.
Well, I think, and I think it's important, and I hope you're seeing it at bigger events. So, like, I was, as you said, as a Perfect Game All-American, and TrackMan was there. Actually, Zeph was there, too, doing their sensor testing and bat speed. And I do think it is important. But the thing is that you have to take it with a grain of salt, too, because you can see somebody that has a really good, say, spin rate on their breaking ball, spin rate on their fastball, and then when you watch the player pitch, you notice that they're using two different release points. And if that's the case, then a hitter's going to be able to pick that up. So it's like they have the raw tools, and you want to be able to see that. You want to be able to have that data. But then how are you able to apply it? Where are the limitations? Because if that player doesn't repeat, you're banking on him having the athleticism to be able to repeat his arm slot, repeat his delivery in that regard, so that those two pitches look more similar or almost identical because they're coming out of the same slot. But the problem is that not every guy can do it. So maybe if the guy that doesn't have the same revolutions, but he creates more deception because everything is coming out of the same look. And so it just gives you another, you know, being able to use that data with amateur players is really important. It's something that it gives you another data point to look at. And more TrackMan and some other technology are available, even at the collegiate level, not just at these high-profile kind of high school showcase events, that are giving analysts within front offices that are helping their amateur scouting department more ammunition, more information to try and help the team make the smart decisions on which players they should pursue.
Yeah, and I think you're asking exactly the right questions. And I guess I would say, you know, not to totally flatter you here, not a lot of radio hosts would go that in-depth into that sort of thing. And so the reason I ask you that is because you do have a national show, and I say one skill you have that I absolutely do not is handling some of the more insane questions without being completely rude to people, which you do almost all of the time. So I want to know, what is your approach on that show between trying to entertain versus trying to educate? Like, obviously, you don't want to turn people off by going too deep into it, but you want to go beyond wins and RBIs. Like, how do you approach that?
Well, thanks for that. First of all, I think for me, I never want to bog down with numbers that don't mean anything. And what have we learned? Well, the pitcher wins and RBIs for hitters really are fairly meaningless statistics when you're trying to evaluate a player overall. So why use them? You know, it's the same as you know, saying there are some announcers that or some hosts that will constantly talk about small sample size data between pitchers and hitters. It just doesn't matter. So I think part of it is you have to be patient with knowing that people don't necessarily have the time in their day to be able to do the amount of research that I'm afforded because it's my job. And so you can kind of create discussion points with it too. But I also don't want to go in, I'm not a hot take guy. I don't care about hot takes. I'd rather base things on facts and you know, actual data and information and try and find what's important. And so I think being able to have a conversation with someone about it, even if they're not necessarily in agreement, I mean, it certainly can get heated. But I really don't try and name call unless somebody's going to name call first. And then I don't have much use for you. My feeling is that if you're taking the time to call your show, call a radio show, then you probably deserve respect unless you're going to be disrespectful of people. And really, I don't have much patience for that in real life. I don't like it when people call in and call organizations or players or whatever stupid or bad or whatnot, because they're not. They really aren't. And I understand that it's a fan reaction and it's a gut reaction, but it doesn't make it right. And I think you should, you know, I don't know, maybe I'm a hippie. Like, I just like to treat people, I hope I treat people fairly well.
Well, I think that's the one I remember recently that you kind of losing it a little bit on, with someone calling up and saying, I think it was the Yankees just weren't trying and weren't showing effort. You know, as that's something you could actually see from the field or whatever actually happened. Listen, I put out a call on Twitter today. Like, I'm going to have Mike Farron on. Who wants a question? And so we're going to go with Ian Miller, our friend from Productive Outs, and I'm going to read this verbatim. Why are the Astros, and also how?
Well, the Astros are because there was expansion in 1961, at the end of the 61 season in 62, and Houston was awarded a franchise. And they decided very early on to change their name from the Colt 45, so that's why. How is, I think, an interesting question just in terms of how are they doing this season. they had, it's kind of quiet. They've got a pretty good starting pitching staff now, and they certainly added reinforcements this year, but they're also a very good defensive team. And so I think one of the major reasons why they've been able to kind of withstand the ebbs and flows of their offense, and certainly that offense has been all or nothing for most of the year, has been that they catch the ball consistently, and they very rarely beat themselves. And I think what you're finding is the teams that overachieve, for the most part, maybe with the Cubs as an exception, although I do think that they've gotten hot as they improve their defense by moving Addison Russell shortstop, is you'll find that they're not giving the other team extra outs. And, you know, like I use Arizona as an example of this, too. They catch the ball, and if you catch the ball, then you're reducing the opportunities for somebody. If you are maybe a tick behind, like, say, in Arizona's case, on the count level on the pitching side, you're reducing the opportunities for somebody to create a multi-run inning by taking advantage of the mistake. That Houston has more talented pitching, certainly. Keuchel has helped that. They get a lot of weak contact. But they have a very good defensive team, especially up the middle. And I think it's a major reason why they sit here now in first place in the AL West.
I know I'm impressed because I asked you such a dumb question and you gave a really well thought out and instructive answer to it. So nicely done there. Mike, final question. What fan base is calling your show panicking the most, and are they right to do so?
Let's see. What fan base is calling it panicking the most? I mean, I think we're past the point of panic with, like, the Tigers. You know, we get some Nationals fans, and certainly they panic. Generally, the answer, you can never go wrong with saying that Mets fans are panicking, because I think it becomes inherent as part of their DNA. I don't know. Maybe it's something that becomes a learned trait, that Mets fans are always panicking. They always think that that there is a dirt cloud surrounding their silver line. So I would have to go with them. But that's a pretty good team. It's going to be. I actually think it's going to end up being a very close race between them.
You know, I agree. I think some of the Mets fans I've heard from think it's over, but I think still six head-to-head games left. The Nationals are finally getting healthy, and you're there tonight to see Gio Gonzalez versus Tyson Ross. Mike, thanks so much for your time. I really appreciate it. Catch Mike Farren on Power Alley on SiriusXM every weekday at 10 a.m. Eastern. Mike, thanks so much. Talk to you soon.
Anytime, Mike. Take care.
With me now, James Wagner from the Washington Post. James, the Nationals have had a pretty disappointing year. Right now, as we speak, they're 63-61, 5.5 games behind the Mets. And you put out a tweet yesterday that I thought was really interesting, and I'm going to read it real quick. And it said, in game 124, the Nationals finally have their projected starting eight players in the lineup for the first time all year. Now, a lot of people think that the issue with this team has been injuries. Do you agree it's that, or do you think it's been something else that's kind of caused these issues?
I mean, if you look back at the season, I think the injuries will probably be top three storylines, you know, things that define the season. It already is. I mean, you know, between Bernard Spann, Jason Worth, Anthony Rendon, Steven Strasburg, Doug Fister, all these other guys have been injured. These are key. They're not just like supplementary players. These are key players. So, I mean, even if, you know, when you lose, I think at one point you lose your leadoff hitter, you know, Ryan Zimmerman, the three-hole hitter, in our span, Jason Worth, you know, hitting in the middle of the order. That stuff takes a big toll. I mean, like, it's really hard. You can plan for as much depth and as many injuries as you can each year, but losing that many guys, even in a lot of them at once, really hurts you. There's nothing really you can really plan for. And some of those guys, even on top of that, went on the DL twice. Bernard Spann, Jason Worth, and Steven Strasburg, to name a few, have been on the DL two times this season. So it's not just that they were injured once and had to deal with it. It's multiple things that have lingered and things that have come up throughout the season. So, yeah, I mean, injuries is a major part. The other things that kind of undermine them throughout the season. But, you know, they still had, if you go back to even early July, they still had, you know, a multiple-game lead despite all those injuries. It's almost the lead that they lost is when those guys get back.
Now, one guy who's not hurt, so far as I know anyway, is Max Scherzer. And in the first half, he was outstanding. And the second half's been a little rough. In the first half, he gave up 10 homers and 132 innings pitched. Second half, he's already up to 8 homers and just 39 innings pitched. Sounds like he's using his fastball a little more, his curve and his slider a little less in the second half. What have you seen from Scherzer that's kind of explained this regression from him?
So, I mean, he insists that he, 2 starts ago in San Diego, where he kind of got shelled by the Giants, he insisted that he found something in his arm action, that he says that he was almost like dropping his shoulder a little bit, and it was causing that he really wasn't whipping his arm like he normally did. He wasn't on top of the ball. And it wasn't moving. His fastball wasn't moving the way it does. You know, Scherzer's kind of unusual anyway. He's got that three-quarters pitch delivery. You know, he released his arm near the ball from really far outside. And it really causes his fastball to move a lot. His fastball spins a lot. It kind of like at the last second dives in on right-handers. It was flat something he said that kind of cropped up, the last several starts before that. So he says that he spotted it, and it's something he's been working on. He's been doing a lot of work in between to kind of avoid that from happening again. His last start, was better, an improvement, a little bit of wildness, but he insists that that's, the problem. He said he's had this before in his career because, it's not an easy arm slot to maintain. It's natural to him, but it still, requires some work. So, he's obviously not hurt. The fastball being flat, he uses it a lot anyway, but being flat allows hitters to, kind of make better contact, hit it out, hit it out. I think that's kind of the biggest thing going on with him in the second half.
Now, as Scherzer's taken a little bit of a step back, somebody who's taken a huge step forward is Stephen Strasburg. And he obviously got off to a really rough start. He's on the disabled list twice. He's made four starts since he's been back off the disabled list. He's given up five earned runs. He's got 32 strikeouts and just three walks. We noted that his curve is up 300 RPM since April, and that's really been a big thing for him, is that curveball. What do you think was Strasburg's issue earlier in the year? And is he, quote-unquote, back, or is this just kind of like a nice small sample from him?
No, I mean, this is some of the best I've seen him throw in a while, not just several years. Like, I mean, he did not really have this kind of velocity that he's showing. It's kind of been a while. But, I mean, so you probably, attribute that to being fresher because he's not pitched as much this season. But, I think just overall, the way he's looked on the mound, he's looked more comfortable, more at ease. And I know, not to go back to the injuries, but it's true. I mean, he had everything started with the ankle injury. He sprained his ankle in spring training, missed only a start then. But really what happens with your body, it's all a chain and connected. So if your ankle is not right, it's causing something in your upper body, you're overcompensating. Then he ended up kind of feeling something in his shoulder blade. Then he ended up hurting, straining his neck, trapezius muscle strain, and he went on the DL for that. So just any little thing that really isn't right, just was kind of affecting him, not really allowing him to feel comfortable. Or throw the fastball down in a way to righties like he was able to before, just could not get the extension. And then as he was coming back from the next train, he had the oblique. So he was pitching really well then. The oblique just happened. He came back from that. The last four starts that he's had, 1.73 ERA. It looked really comfortable. He's pumping the fastball. It was sitting, 95, 97 the entire time, the last start. So he looked really, really good.
Now, you wrote something interesting about Bryce Harper the other day, which is that he's actually hitting better against the shift than without the shift on. I think he's hitting 302 against grounders against the shift, only 276 without the shift. Now, have you spoken to him about that? Is that something he's actively trying to work on, not to get caught up in that shift so much?
Yeah, I mean, he says he doesn't really notice the shift. It's not something he pays attention to. I think that's something that he would say to us in a group setting after a game. But I think he internalizes a lot and thinks about these things a lot. So I would say he does think about it. He does notice that they're shifting against them. They're doing it more this year than they ever have before, because he's actually pulling the ball more this year, hitting it more to right field than he had in the past. So I don't know. I mean, I think just being more under control in his swing and his approach is kind of leading to this and helping him kind of combat this. Look, in the past, it's something that one of the things that's almost defined his season that stood out to me too, about his power too. And the power's always been there, but he always, tried to muscle it up too much, try to hit it as far as possible. And he learned this year it's more about how many, not how far. So I think by controlling his body, his head is stiller, controlling his bat better, not really trying to swing for, the third deck, he can really, hit the ball down the left field line if he needs to, and there shouldn't be against him. And control the bat better and just hit the ball to all fields when he needs to.
Now, I was very interested last week to see that the Nationals called up shortstop prospect Trey Turner, who they got from San Diego in that three-way deal last year that really looks like it's going to be a steal. They got Joe Ross out of that as well. And obviously Turner is a very highly thought of prospect, but what's interesting is that Ian Desmond had really started to turn things around. If you look at weighted runs created plus, where 100 is average, his first half he was 60, which is actually pretty terrible, and second half 136, which is really good. Were you surprised to see the timing of that call-up for Turner?
A little bit, though. I mean, I did not see that coming on that day. It was about a week plus before the September 1st, roster expanding, and he was obviously, going to come up then. So, yeah, I mean, the fact is that they were playing short on the bench anyway. They had guys before, like Tyler Moore, Dan Ugla, before they landed on the DL, and now they have Clint Robinson. Guys that really could only play first or second or, left field. So they weren't really versatile and then they were playing short on the bench anyway. So they figured, if they're gonna have a guy play short on the bench anyway, they might have someone that's versatile. It kind of offers a unique skill set. Trey Turner is very unique. Scouts have graded him at 70 on the speed, the 2080 scale. So this is a plus speed. I think think that the one day he was up here, his first day, you know, after he was called up in the majors, he hit 22 miles an hour, according to your guys' StatCast statistic, going home to the first base. So he's a very, very fast runner. It's really special to watch. So he kind of brings that unique skill set. And so, yeah, I mean, he might not get a lot of starts. Danny Espinosa is probably higher up on the is higher up on the pecking order in terms of guys who could probably get starts in the middle infield as well, along with Ian Desmond and Anthony Rendon. But Turner, if they put him in a spot, you know, steal a base, get some pinch hit appearances here and there, you know, maybe an occasional start in September if they need a day off to someone. But still, though, he's a skill set they did not have really presently. They didn't really have a lot of speed. And on top of that, some of the guys that normally have the speed before, like Bernard Spann, Anthony Rendon, have dealt with numerous, you know, injuries affecting their speed this season. So, you know, he helps them in that sense.
One guy I have to ask you about is Michael Taylor, who's going to probably lose a bit of playing time now that Denard Span is back. Last week, he hit the longest home run in the StatCast era, 492 feet in Colorado, and we did the math, and obviously Colorado added 20-something feet on that ball. But you look at Michael Taylor, he's not a guy who you just like stare at his physique and think, look at this guy's muscular. Were you surprised to see him put that kind of power on the ball?
No, actually, to be honest, I was not, honestly, because I think that people see him on TV – that don't see him, you know, up close. But, you know, on TV with the uniform, he looks like a pretty, you know, tall, 6'3", skinny type guy. But really, you know, in shorts and a T-shirt when he's working out or in the clubhouse, he's actually pretty built. Strong, kind of that wiry strength. He's also still very fast, 6'3", and, you know, has really rangy in the outfield. Has been one of the best defensive outfielders in baseball if you look at the advanced stats. So, no, I mean, he's a very strong guy. The thing with him is that he needs to make more contact. When he does make contact, he hits it long and he hits it far, you know, like a line drive type hitter. But with him, it's, you know, just he's young, getting used to the approach, kind of getting exposed by major league pitching. So, you know, just cutting down the strikeouts and making more contact. So, you know, I've seen him hit some really impressive BP. He hits the ball really far to center field, too. It can really hit it far the other way as well. So I've seen it. It just hasn't really shown it enough. It's shown it, but not enough. And I think in the future, if he can kind of hone that ability, I think he has the talent to be a 2020 veteran.
Briefly on Jason Wirth, we are almost five full years into his seven-year, $126 million contract. And in those 5 years, he's had one average year, two very, very good years, and now two basically lost years. What's your position on that contract now most of the way through it, and how much hope do you have for the remaining 2 years at age 37 and 38?
That's a tough one. I mean, it's still in process. He's still got a couple years more left. But I don't know. I mean, he was part of the changing of the, you know, the culture in the clubhouse and personnel-wise. He was the big first free agent signing of this current class of, like, big Nats players. You know, he has played a huge part in the clubhouse and kind of helping, you know, guys reach this point. Everything he's played a part in everything from, like, helping change the clubhouse food to make it better for guys, standing up for players, to the organization internally, a leader for the guys. So in that sense, that stuff is tangible. Some people don't see that. It's really hard to quantify statistically, obviously, but he means he's meant a lot to the players that are here now too, for that reason. But yeah, I mean, like if you had asked me at the end of maybe the, you know, 13-14 season when he played really well, I'd say, you know, the contract was looking pretty good because he had put together. I mean, 13-14, he was, you know, top 10 hitter in baseball. If you look at some of the advanced statistics, runs created, and OPS, and things like that. But since then, you know, the problem with him is that he's 36 years old. His body has, you know, kind of broken down in certain senses. You know, his left wrist is an area of weakness. And got hit by a pitch this year, and because he's had so many things before, it's a sensitive area. So with him, you know, I don't know. I mean, like $120 million for a player like him might seem like a lot, but I think he was kind of what the organization needed at the time to usher in this current class.
James, final question for you. As we speak, the Nationals are 5.5 games out. We have them at 11.2% odds to win the National League East, but they do still have 6 head-to-head games, and as we talked about, they're getting healthy. Do the Nats make that comeback, and do they overtake the Mets?
Oh, man. I don't have a crystal ball. I can't see in the future. But I'd say, you know, like, if they can keep this deficit manageable going into those 6 head-to-head matchups, you know, I think, you know, their fate is in their own hands. Like, you know, I think, you know, the Mets are obviously playing really well. They're a very good team. Their offense has really been energized, you know, with the trades of, you know, Yoan Cespedes and addition of Kelly Johnson, Juan Uribe at the trade deadline. And they just played really well since then. You know, there's something to be said about a kind of like a new group of players, you know, winning for the first time, really, you know, independent races and the excitement that comes with it. Obviously, their starting rotation is really, really good, and that kind of prevents them from having this long, extended kind of losing streak. So I don't know. I mean, like, I think the Nats, from their point of view, with the way they see it, is that they have more experience. They've been more battle-tested in August and September. They've done this before. So they kind of know what it takes to play the 1-2. There's a lot of guys in the Mets that are young. They really have not been through a 1-2 before. You know, maybe some of those young starters, what are they going to do with Matt Harvey, Noah Syndergaard, you know, in their first season back from injury and in most of the rookie season? Will they be worn down by September? Obviously, the Mets are going to do everything they can to make sure those two guys are available for those series. But how will they be pitching? Will they be pitching balls up, getting tired? So I don't know. We'll see. I mean, I think there are some things that work in the Nats' favor, but obviously the Nats have dug in such a big hole to the point that they're almost relying on a lot of other factors to help them too.
James Wagner from the Washington Post. Follow him at JamesWagnerWP. James, thanks for joining us today. I really appreciate it.
No problem, Mike. I appreciate it. Thanks for having me.
Yep. Take care. This has been the MLB.com StatCast podcast. I'm Mike Petriello. Thanks to my guests, James Wagner and Mike Farron. Catch you next week.